Welcome to KABU, Jane Hassinger.
Oh, it's good to be here.
Well, you and your team at the University of Michigan Ann Arbor have been carrying out research on abortion stigma for many years now, research based on the experiences of providers in countries around the world. And as many of us know, since Trump's inauguration, this work has gotten harder, and that in addition to local laws restricting access to abortion in many places, providers face an increasingly harsh set of policies from the U.S. side. So before we talk about your work, could you just say a bit about what the gag rule is and how it affects women and healthcare workers around family planning services around the world?
Sure. Well, as you know, the gag rule, or what has been known as the Mexican rule, goes back to the administration of Ronald Reagan. It's waxed and waned in terms of its implementation, depending on whether or not we have a Democrat or Republican in office. But the gag rule impacts U.S. funding or USAID funding to reproductive and health care services around the world by means of withholding funds from any service that offers or promotes abortion, even including those services that also offer a full spectrum of health care for community members. So, you know, that could include family planning services, childhood vaccinations, HIV/AIDS testing and care, malaria, Ebola, and other infectious diseases. The policy has drastic impacts, therefore, on the health care of communities throughout the world. And because it's kind of poorly spelled out, it's sketched out in very broad terms, it tends to be that people are afraid of the loss of financial support, and so do tend to interpret it broadly, and if there's any chance at all that they might be perceived as promoting abortion, they don't talk about it. The fear of talking about abortion among recipients of USAID ultimately puts women at risk, women and their children and their families.
And that's a very important part of the research you do on abortion stigma. It both involves the policy material conditions that affect access to abortion, but also how the psychological and interpersonal dynamics that are part of this as well. People who enact these policies do understand at a certain level that they're meant to scare people and to shrink the worlds and lives and reaches of women and other marginalized groups. Can you say a little bit about what provider share encompasses and your approach to abortion stigma?
Provider share was an intervention conceived over 10 years ago. We've been at this now for 10 years. Based on our observation that abortion providers don't talk about the work they do. And we know that women who seek abortions for years have been stigmatized, but very little was understood about how stigma works to influence the experiences of abortion providers. And so we had the notion that we'd like to learn more about that, but we'd also like to provide some support for providers, presuming that working really under the great pressure associated with abortion stigma would be tough, hard on people's mental health, hard on esprit de corps, really, in teams of providers. So we designed a workshop to both support providers to create a space where providers could safely talk about the work they do with one another, and also as a research intervention, a way to collect data to learn a good deal more. We noticed that the stigma about abortion provision and about providers is so intense that very little research even had been done. There was a very scant literature on the experiences of abortion providers, which is striking given that they are a highly trained, dedicated workforce, and there was almost nothing out there. So we wanted to contribute to the research literature as well as provide support for providers. And we designed a workshop that, when we began, it was a six-session workshop facilitated by a trained group leader. And we learned a lot from that first pilot project 10 years ago.
Before you continue with yeah. some of your findings, the first, I think, question that comes to mind is how we think about stigma in a context where there are clear legal ramifications to talking about it. And providing abortions. And of course, there is some latitude, perhaps you could talk about the legal latitude for abortion and how creatively that's used in different places in the world, and how you would distinguish between the political aspects of not speaking about something and stigma that carries more of this kind of psychological, psychosocial loading.
Well, it's a complicated factor, as you're suggesting. In places where abortion is legal, for example, in the United States, abortion stigma remains very strong. In some countries like Ghana, where abortion is basically legal and accessible, the attitudes that people carry about abortion are still so highly stigmatized that people actually don't know that abortion is legal in their countries. As abortion becomes more and more stigmatized and more regulated in the United States, we've learned that there are parts of the United States where people also don't know that abortion is legal and accessible. So stigma does a lot to confuse people about what their rights are and where the legal services are.
And over-internalizing, you're saying, repression isn't only an externally imposed force, but something that is reproduced in this
reproduced
way.
Over and over and over again, absolutely. The campaigns of stigma that we've seen in the United States in the last 10 or so years have been extraordinary and extraordinarily successful at influencing policymakers, at influencing changes in laws, increased regulations that have made, in some parts of the country, abortion virtually inaccessible. I think the last time I checked, in as many as 85% of American counties, abortion is not accessible. Yes, right. So stigma as a psychological and social political phenomenon has had profound effects.
Now, there are many groups around the world working with reproductive health organizations or staff that include some component of what's called values clarification in addressing sometimes ambivalence or conflict, and often the conflict that workers bring to whatever the legal situation is in determining if and when women can terminate a pregnancy. Can you say a bit about how your work is similar to or different from these values clarification workshops?
Sure. You know, our first concern really was to provide a safe, roomy enough space so that women providers could think deeply into what their work means to them and to share stories, complex stories about the moral intricacies involved in providing abortion. And we knew that that would take time and space. It would take building trust among members. It would take the opportunities for really taking risks with one another. A values clarification approach is certainly useful in getting clearer on what an individual's beliefs are, but it's a very limited intervention. It focuses basically on, you know, do I believe in women's right to abortion or not? I think the provider share workshop goes much more deeply, as I said, into the complexities of the issue and at a group level and a political level. It takes time to stretch out and to really dig deeply into those issues, and we wanted to provide time. We also wanted to provide time and space for ambivalence, as you mentioned. There needs to be room for ambivalence around such profound issues. We've also observed that the political climate that we live in now regarding abortion has pulled the debates and the discussion into very polarized shape, in a real situation in which one is not offered the opportunity to think in complex terms, is not offered the opportunity to be ambivalent. And we wanted to correct that situation in the workshop.
There's also a theory of groups that guides this work, that these are not simply internal or intrapsychic conflicts, but are carried by groups and addressed by groups. Can you say something about that in terms of other findings you might mention?
Well, you mean the team itself?
Well, there's both the group as a team, your own work, but you also work with groups and a concept of group dynamics when you address and kind of open up space for people to draw on each other and to allow for ambivalence.
Yeah, we chose a group strategy for a couple of reasons. One is that we see the group, let's say in a team of abortion providers, as serving as a kind of microcosm of larger social dynamics out in the world. And that if members of the group have time to think together and to explore their experiences and reactions together, some of those dynamics in the outer world will begin to emerge. And people can begin to situate themselves as citizens in relation to some of these difficult issues, social and moral issues, as they talk and work together. Their attention then goes not only to their experiences in their teams with one another, but to their experiences out in the world, where they might do something like influence policy or become advocates or activists in various ways. So there's a lot of attention focused on what we learn here together as a group has applications out in the world to other groups in which we're members and participants.
This seems to also be related to, and perhaps we could close by talking a bit about the politics of shame. The shame studies has kind of emerged and has a certain cachet now in the humanities particularly. And it seems to me that your work very much relates to group dynamics related to shame,
mm-hmm.
abortion shame.
Well, stigma relies heavily on shame. And one of the things we point out to participants in our workshops is that stigma needs to be mobilized at a group level and has a set of dynamics that involve manipulating feelings of guilt and shame. And it's often very helpful to people to be able to see that what they're experiencing, which they regard as a highly personal individual experience, has its roots actually in a social dynamic out in the world, and that shame is used to manipulate people. Recently, I heard a story on NPR about a program developed by a group of anti-abortion activists that focuses on identifying ambivalent abortion providers and inviting them to quit their jobs using the enticement of offering money to quit their jobs as providers. And one of the ways they do that is by magnifying and manipulating shame and guilt.
And offering this also kind of quasi-therapeutic experience or a come-to-Jesus
moment. Experience. Yeah. Exactly. So shame and guilt are tactics used to intensify and spread stigma.
And so this is part of what you help people understand and interpret their experiences as well as to overcome the isolation attached often or as a product of shame.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or stigma.
Overcome isolation, clarify what the work, you know, means, make room for ambivalence, all of those things. Now, a secondary effect of this, we learned, much to our great satisfaction, is that the workshop does seem to have a positive effect at the team level in terms of increasing esprit de corps, improving teamwork, and we hope we'll see over time an impact on things like attrition.
In closing, there's also a film that should be available that we jointly carried out called Kuepo that grew out of this work, and we'll let listeners know how they can see that and other reports from your ongoing projects that give us a sense of hope as well as to counter our own feelings of shame that we have this administration in office. We should be ashamed. But we'll continue to follow this important work and keep it up.
Thank you, Jan.
Okay, this is Jan Hawken talking this morning with Jane Hassinger, the University of Michigan Ann Arbor, about the Provider Share team and their work around abortion, with abortion stigma around the world. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
I arrived and pressed G5, and there was Nikki looking some kind of sad with tears falling from her eyes. She sat me down and dug my frown and began to run it down. You remember my boyfriend Sid, that fly kid who I love? Well, our love was often a verb, and spontaneity has brought a third. But due to our youth and economic state, we wish to terminate. About this we don't feel great, but baby, that's how it is. But the feds have dissed me, they ignored and dismissed me. The pro-lifers harassed me outside the clinic and called me a murderer. Now that's hate. So needless to say, we're in a mental state of debate.